The question was, how can I respect somebody who calls me a self-hating Jew? How do I respond? My usual response is to say, let's assume it's true that I'm a self-hating Jew. For argument's sake, let's assume it's true. Does that change whether or not the facts are true? If I were a self-loving Jew, does that mean everything I say is true? And if I'm self-hating, as is alleged, it seems to me that it doesn't bear on the question of whether or not what I'm saying is true. So for argument's sake, let's say Albert Einstein was a self-hating Jew. Does that mean that E does not equal MC squared, but it equals MC cubed? Does that make any sense? And I don't think it does. I don't have any special knowledge of Palestinian public opinion either here or in the occupied territories, and people like Jody are much more qualified than me to speak on that, not to mention there are many Palestinians in the audience. I would just want to comment that there was something quite unusual about what happened in Gaza, because in all of Israel's previous engagements with its neighbors, there was a component, a military component, to their combat. The 67 war, it was basically a battlefield war, although as the U.S. national security person Rostow put it, it was a turkey shoot, but it was basically between combatants. 73 was a real war. In Lebanon in the 90s, in the early 80s and then in the 90s, it was a mixture of targeting civilians and military engagements. What made Gaza quite unique was that there was no military component to what happened. It was just an intentional direct assault on the civilian population for a very simple reason. Because Israel wanted to restore what it called its deterrence capacity, the Arab world's fear of Israel, but it didn't have a military target among combatants. It didn't want to attempt again an attack on the Hezbollah because it wasn't ready to. It couldn't target Iran because the United States said no. And so it looked around and it decided we'll target Gaza. But the problem with Gaza was there was no armed force to speak of. So how do you restore your military capacity, how do you restore your deterrence capacity if there's no military foe? If you defeat Hamas, you're not going to restore the Arab world's fear of you, because everybody knows Hamas has no military power. So Israel decided the way it was going to restore its deterrence capacity was to target the civilian population and the civilian infrastructure, and thereby transmit the message to the Arab world, if you mess with us, forget about battles, forget about combatants, we're going to destroy your entire civilian infrastructure and target civilians. And that made it quite unique, and it came through. And that's why there was so much more outrage after the massacre in Gaza than previous engagements between Israel and its neighbors.
Jody, I'm interested to hear more about your background. What got you more interested to get you to go to Palestine in the first place? Is it a family connection or is it just an interest? And also, for low-key, I'm just wondering, what are your major, you know, musical influences, especially when it comes to, like, this type of activist music, and why have you done it instead of to pursue more popular rights of music?
Okay. Before I answer this question, I just want to come back to the question the first gentleman asked. I think it's dangerous to see the massacre in Gaza as an isolated event, because of course, as we all know, the siege of Gaza did not begin when Israel launched Operation Cast Lead, and the suffering of the Palestinian people did not begin when the F-16s and the white phosphorus bombs began to fall on the people of Gaza. But I think one growing trend, if you like, we are seeing in the Palestinian political arena is the latest wave of this non-violent resistance movement that I spoke about this evening. This, I can't emphasize enough, this is the thing that Israel are terrified of. It's very difficult to somehow justify shooting at unarmed protesters. It's very difficult to make out that a man standing with his arms in the air chanting is some kind of threat to you. And we're seeing now an increased wave of aggression on the part of the Israeli occupation forces. Just a few weeks ago, they went into Nablus and murdered three fathers in cold blood. In Jerusalem, they are increasing the oppression of the Palestinian people, the checkpoints, and making people's lives more difficult than ever. And in my opinion, this is an attempt on the part of the Israeli occupation to provoke a third intifada, a third uprising. But I think the most important thing is that when this uprising occurs, because I think it will occur, is that it is done in a creative manner, in a non-violent way, in order to harness the support of the world. I'm not saying this from a moral judgment, because of course, under international law, any occupied people have a right to resistance, armed or non-armed. But from a view of how effective it is, I think the non-violent resistance movement that is growing so much now will be the start of the end of the occupation. Now, in answer to the second question, my grandmother is originally Lebanese, and in 2006, of course, Israel invaded Lebanon again, and she was showing me the events on the news, telling me, look at what's happening over there. And from there, I heard about the struggle of the Palestinian people. And it struck me then, and still strikes me today, as the biggest injustice in the world. and I began writing articles about Palestine, and I thought to myself, if you want to write about a situation, it's of great importance to go and see the reality with your own eyes. I only planned originally to go to Palestine for a month, but I ended up staying 9 months, so I think my mother was a bit surprised. But I mean, the difference between then, 4 years ago, when Israel invaded Lebanon, and now, is that 4 years ago, people didn't even know the word Palestine. I think we were at a much earlier stage of the struggle as we are now. And I think the massacre in Gaza, as tragic as it was, has provoked a huge change in public opinion.
Okay, I'll keep it short and sweet. I was inspired by many people, ranging from Gil Scott Heron to Marvin Gaye. But I think mainly for me, it was looking at hip-hop as something the older I got, it was trying to sell me a lifestyle, and it was trying to sell me products, which ultimately I didn't feel reflected within that. I didn't feel like someone like me even had a voice, or that I could relate to many of these artists because they were boasting about a lifestyle which I didn't know much about. So ultimately, that's what inspired me to do that and to, you know, speak my mind and speak what I see as the truth, because I think that's important.
Dr. Finkelstein, you addressed the need to find a solution to the problems that we've been hearing about tonight. And as you, of course, know, there's quite a heated debate developing between those who favor a one-state solution, an idea that's picked up a great number of adherents over the last several years, and the more traditional position of the two-state solution. And I'm wondering where you stand, and perhaps our other speakers, Jody and Lil P, this evening, on this debate between the one-state and two-state positions.
I'm always a little bit reluctant to enter this terrain because it causes divisiveness, and I'd rather to be focused on what joins us and getting to work on ending the occupation. But it seems very difficult to evade the question, and I do believe it's needed that there be clarity on it. I think one of the problems with the way the question is posed, it's always asked, what do you support? As if politics were about your personal preferences, as if politics were like a Chinese menu. I'll take one from column A and two from column B. But I don't think that's what politics is about. Politics is about what is possible, what is feasible, and what helps advance the struggle for a decent life for people. And that's what we should focus on, what's possible, what's feasible, and what enables people to live better lives. And when I was reading Gandhi the past year, I sort of got a clearer perception of what a real political agenda is about. Gandhi said, politics is not about trying to change people's opinions. Politics is not about trying to change public opinion. Politics is about trying to get people to act on what they already know is wrong. So in the 1930s, Mr. Gandhi launches a campaign to rid India of alcoholism, a real problem in India. And many people say, but Mr. Gandhi, why do you focus on alcoholism? Why don't you focus on racetrack betting, also a problem? The cinema, Gandhi considered it sinful. Why don't you focus on those things? And Mr. Gandhi responded, well, the answer is obvious, because there's already a public consensus in India that alcoholism is wrong. But there's no consensus that racetrack betting and so on are wrong. So our job is, to use Gandhi's expression, we want to quicken the conscience of the public. That is to say, to get the public to act on what it already knows is wrong. And I think comparably, analogously, that's our job here today. Namely, there is a consensus in the international community. You can see it every year in the United Nations General Assembly. There's a vote called Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question. And every year the vote is the same. It calls for a two-state settlement in the June 67 border with a resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. The whole world votes on one side. The past year it was 164 countries, including Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the other side is a handful of countries led by Israel and the United States, and including this past year, Australia, Nauru, Palau, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. For those of you who don't know Nauru and Palau, their collective populations can fit in the empty seats in this room. So there is a consensus. There is an agreement. The problem is the countries which agree, they don't do anything about it. It's just like in our American South. There were federal laws enacted, judicial decisions made, which said separate but equal is illegal, which said denying the rights of black people the right to vote is illegal. But those laws were not enforced. And it was then the task of the civil rights movement, including white people, to use the weapon of civil disobedience to quicken the conscience of our federal government, to force them to enforce the laws which were the laws of the land, to quicken their conscience. And that, to me, is our job now. I don't think our job is trying to change the consensus, because that's a very long struggle. You want to change the consensus to one state? We're talking about several generations. The law changes very, very slowly, because it's always built on precedent. For those who are legal scholars in this room, there are many of my students who went on to law school, they know. It always builds on precedent. It's very hard to change. And I don't have it in me to go to my friends in the occupied territories and tell them, you see this murderous occupation, this brutal occupation? Well, it's going to go on for decade after decade after decade until we change public opinion. I say, let's try to get public opinion to act on what it already knows is wrong and to end the occupation. Some of you feel that's not really very much, and I hear many people say, no, I want something like South Africa. We want the South Africa solution. I hear that all the time. And to me, it's a kind of bewildering statement. I was in South Africa a few months ago. I have to tell you, in my entire life, and I've traveled, I have never seen poverty like I saw in South Africa. I mean, it was just, it was mind-boggling. I went to visit Gandhi's home, and Gandhi's home is right next to how the people live. And I asked Gandhi's granddaughter, Ella Gandhi, I said to her, what percent of South Africans live like that? It was just like a garbage heap. She said about 60 to 80%. So, ending apartheid, I think everyone here will agree, it was a great historic victory. But does that mean the struggle is over? And it's the same thing in the occupied territories. ending the occupation is just, to refer to those black spirituals again, it's just one rung on Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. Each rung goes higher and higher. It's just one rung. But ending apartheid was also one rung. It's a significant rung. And if I live to see Israel withdraw from the occupied territories, I will be very glad and exhilarated to have been part of the struggle, but always recognizing it's just one rung on Jacob's ladder, but it's still an important rung. Well, I want to also hear from Jody and Kareem Loki on that. I just want to answer the very last part of your statement. There is the question, why focus on Israel and not equally focus on Egypt? Part of the answer for me goes something like this. Amnesty International, as I mentioned to you earlier, after the massacre in Gaza, it put out a report which everybody here should read. And the report is called A Fueling Conflict, about who's causing this nightmare in Gaza. And the report was actually, as I said, was much more aggressive than Mr. Goldstone, because Amnesty International said that there has to be a complete, absolute, total, comprehensive arms embargo on Israel, instituted by the United Nations, the Security Council, and also individual countries. And then it said three facts. Number one, it said, as we all know in this room, the United States is the chief arms supplier for Israel. Number two, it said, supplying weapons to a consistent violator of human rights is illegal under international and domestic U.S. law. And number three, it said, and it's probably the most compelling statement, very striking seeing it in print. Number three, it said, you see what happened in Gaza? It said what happened in Gaza could not have happened, now I'm quoting it, without U.S. taxpayer money. That's what Amnesty said. And that's literally the truth. As I mentioned in my remarks, literally, it's hard to believe, every single white phosphorus shell used in Gaza was made in the U.S., every single one. And so for that reason, it seems to me proper that we focus on what our U.S. taxpayer monies are doing. What Egypt is doing is appalling, and I'm not going to make any excuses for that. You know, no, what Israel is doing, and in many ways it was shameful. I have a very good, you know, Egyptian friend of audience, Azza Layton. But I had many friends who were in Egypt during the massacre, and they told me that, you know, there was very little support for the Gazans, and it was not just because of the repression. The Egyptian people didn't care. That's a very sorry commentary, you know. But I think we have to be clear. It's Israel that dropped the white phosphorus. It's Israel that used disproportionate force designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. And it was Israel, backed by and made possible by, and to quote Amnesty International, U.S. taxpayer money. And that should be our priorities. And now, Loki and Jody.
I'd like to speak on this a little bit. As somebody that when we traveled to Gaza, we were held for 6 days by the Egyptian government. And something I might like to make clear to everyone is Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, has been the president of that country since 1981. Now, as I mentioned before, as an American military base there, they have fostered this elite which is entirely reliant on keeping on American money, as you stated. But it's an elite which is oppressing the majority of the country. Poverty I saw in Egypt was actually more surprising and more shocking than any poverty I witnessed in West Bank or Gaza within Egypt. So, as I said, this government is entirely reliant on the United States, so therefore they could never actually exercise any independence of their own in terms of lifting the siege on Gaza or in terms of, on their side, playing a certain role. It would never happen because, as I said, they are entirely reliant on the enablers, and the enablers in this situation is the United States government.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with a lot of what Loki and Norman said. I also experienced this in Egypt while I was on my way to Gaza. We were attacked by the Egyptian police in El Arish. And I also want to tell a little story. An Egyptian friend of mine was bringing my wheelchair to the airport when I was leaving, and the taxi driver asked her why she was so stressed out, why she was in such a hurry, and she began telling him, "Oh, my friend has been in Gaza for the last couple of months," and he was so angry by this that he threw my wheelchair off the roof of the car and told her to leave the vehicle in the middle of the motorway. But one thing that I would disagree with is that I don't think it's necessarily fair to say that the Egyptian people don't care about Gaza or don't have an interest in the plight of the Gazan people. But I think the acquiescence of the Egyptian and Jordanian governments, like Loki touched upon, is part of a much wider thing. This is imperialism in its most blatant form. And unfortunately, until the Israeli occupation ends, this will continue. Of course, the corrupt dictators ruling many countries in the Arab world is a problem that should be recognized. The biggest problem in the Middle East, I think we would all agree on, is the political ideology of Zionism and the Israeli occupation of Palestine. It's vital that all our efforts are working towards bringing an end to this occupation.
Can I just add one thing about that? I personally don't believe that this dictatorship they have in Egypt is in any way representative of the Egyptian people. Yeah, anybody that thinks that Egypt is anybody that has been to, as much as any other of these propped up dictators in the Middle East are, there's a lot of talk about democracy, and one of the reasons supposedly for the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan was to bring democracy. Well, how much does the United States government care about democracy in Egypt? They would sincerely love it, I think. But the point is this.
because of it being a disputed territory and all that.
Sorry, I didn't understand. Did you ask what are the international peace rules? Okay. No, it's okay, I understand. A good example of this is like the Hanun family that I was talking about that were evicted from their home in Jerusalem. There were people of many different nationalities, not least which people of Israeli nationalities. The same thing in Belaim, people came from around the world to support this struggle. But although the Palestinian people are so grateful for this solidarity, a lot of people told me the most important thing is what people do in their own countries. And I want to say, when I was in Belaim, a friend of mine from the village, a guy called Iyad, wrote a call out to for people from around the world to make regular demonstrations, to support the regular demonstrations happening in Belaim and Nailin and Gaza and across Palestine. And he put the emphasis on the word regular to show that this occupation is continuing every day. The situation is not getting better. Now, in response to this, activists in London started a bi-weekly demonstration every other Saturday outside a shop called Ahava in central London. Now this shop, Ahava, sells products that are produced in illegal settlements in the West Bank, like the one built on my friend's land in Belaim. But these products, although they are produced illegally under international law, are still being sold on our high streets. So these demonstrations I'm talking about that are starting in London now, why can't we have this happening regularly here in Chicago and in cities across America? I think if this happened across the world and across America, it would become a big story in the media. People would start to question, why is this happening? Why is this happening on such a large scale? And if we build a movement like that of nonviolent resistance against the occupation, then we can support the nonviolent resistance movement growing in Palestine. Thank you.
If we could just get one more round of applause, it's included in that round of applause for Joy Ryan.